Anders, what are you doing?
You said you wanted a baby driver, so I was getting the stuff ready.
Okay, there are so many problems with this. First of all, it is not a kid's movie. Second of all, you're not a baby. You're 7 now. And third of all, how do I say this delicately? You don't know how to drive.
I know that. It's not for me.
Well, who's it for then?
For Joss. I drive too.
I have to admit, I did not see that coming.
Welcome to the conversation.
Well, I got to give his.
Welcome to the podcast. We are so excited this week to talk about Baby Driver, the latest film from the person that I can't remember his name because I'm that prepared.
Edgar Wright.
There it is, from Edgar Wright. And we are really excited to welcome back our friend of the show, Jeffrey Overstreet. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well,
it's been a while.
Yeah. The last time we had you on was the indie surprise Sing Street, and we have you on for another somewhat indie surprise, or at least an indie blockbuster, if there's such a thing. All of a sudden, there's this wave of hype for Baby Driver. It's great to have you on. We're really excited. Before we talk about the film, we should say up front that gloves are off in terms of spoilers. If that's an issue and you want to see the film before that, feel free to do so and come back. But we're gonna get right into it. Baby Driver tells the story of a young getaway driver named, wait for it, Baby. And after being coerced into working for a crime boss, he finds himself taking part in a heist that may be doomed to fail. Meanwhile, he falls in love with the girl at the diner next door, if you will. And what will he do? Will he be able to get out on his own, or will he just succumb to the life that he is accustomed to? It is directed, as we said, by Edgar Wright, and I think it premiered at, was it Sundance?
I actually don't remember myself, but I know that when it opened, and it may have been Sundance, that it generated such a tidal wave of enthusiasm that it looked like it was going to be the surprise hit of the summer.
Yes. In fact, I think the original release date was in the middle of August, and they moved it up to the long weekend or the weekend before Independence Day, which is a huge, huge move. And so there certainly was a lot of anticipation for this film. But Jeffrey, why don't we talk about it?
I just looked it up, and it was South by Southwest, actually.
There it is.
March 11th.
Okay.
That's where it premiered. Well, I'm a huge fan of Edgar Wright. I think he's one of the most consistently satisfying creative chemists, I'll say, going in film right now. You've probably seen more Edgar Wright films than you realize, because I've mentioned Baby Driver quite a bit recently, and people have said, I don't know who Edgar Wright is. And I said, well, you've seen Shaun of the Dead. Oh, yes, of course. Well, you've seen Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Oh, he did that. You know, and suddenly you realize that this creative genius has made so many fun, unexpected, slightly under the radar films that have gone on to become cult classics that you almost can't call them cult classics anymore, because their accumulated popularity has led people to say, oh, I just saw this crazy movie called The World's End with Simon Pegg. And yeah, other people will say, well, you know, that's part of a trilogy. Pretty soon everybody is a fan of the Cornetto trilogy, which isn't really,
yes,
a trilogy, except insofar as it has some thematic elements and a few details for those with eyes to see, so to speak, that connect the three films. And a lot of the cast are the same, but it's not an ongoing story about the same characters. But they all have that personality of taking an established genre and fulfilling the demands of that genre enthusiastically and colorfully and inventively, but then spoofing the genre in certain ways at the same time, and then packing every single scene with references to other films in that genre and surprises. Hot Fuzz, which is the middle film in the Cornetto trilogy, is a spoof of buddy cop movies, and not a genre I'm particularly fond of, partly because it's so overdone and predictable. But Hot Fuzz is so full of hilarious send-ups of the genre, while also making you care about how it's going to end, that I don't know. I just kept going back to it again and again and again to see how cleverly it was stitched together. And every time I did, I made another big surprise, like, who is the actress playing Simon Pegg's ex-girlfriend in the movie? We see her in a hospital, but she's always got a mask over her face. And actually, no, we don't see her in a hospital. We see her at a crime scene, but she's got a mask over her face. And the movie never gives away the surprise. You just have to recognize the eyes or you don't get it at all. Peter Jackson actually makes a cameo appearance in Hot Fuzz that you'll miss if you blink. So I would say, as far as joke density, I guess it's the best term for it, Edgar Wright's films are just loaded. And yeah, listening to the commentaries on the video releases of those films is such a rewarding experience, because you learn so much more than you realize was going on. So Edgar Wright's fans are becoming fiercely loyal, because they know that they're not about to see just a great movie. They're about to see, for the first time, a great movie that they're going to revisit again and again and again.
Yeah.
So I came to this just ready, expecting to see an immediate favorite. Have you seen all of the other Edgar Wright films?
I haven't seen them all. I have not seen Hot Fuzz.
Oh, that's my favorite.
I loved Shaun of the Dead and At World's End. Actually, it's funny, I went back. At World's End is on Netflix here. I don't know if it's in the U.S., but it is in Canada. So I went back, revisited it, and I forgot just how much I enjoyed it. Like, just how much spark there is to the story and how it pops. And yeah, okay, you could make an argument that it's very, like, the story structure and all, how it sort of plays out is actually very similar to Shaun of the Dead in some ways. But it's just, it's so entertaining. And Scott Pilgrim. Oh, go ahead.
It's structured around this pub crawl.
Yeah.
You know, where they go from one bar to another. And one of the things you'll enjoy more and more the more you watch it is seeing how the names of the pubs actually refer to important points in the story.
Yeah.
And how the personalities of the different pubs are very cleverly designed to reward, you know, however much attention you bring to them. So.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll talk about this in a few minutes, you talk about Baby Driver, but I noticed that there too, is there was so much going on visually that just to see, you know, just things going on in the background to sort of bring to life what's happening in the foreground. But of course, I mean, I wouldn't be a good Toronto boy if I wasn't in love with Scott Pilgrim versus the World. I mean, any movie where after you kill a bad guy, loonies drop to the ground. I mean, this is just great. Now, I know that's not his original source material, but there's such pop to it. And it's such a unique way to tell the story that it sort of draws you in. It's so ironic because a film like this, now, my understanding is this is the film that came of the broken marriage that was Ant-Man. And, yes. But looking at the history of his films, you know, you can sort of get this sense that he's not going to fit into a Marvel mold. He's going to try and, like, the way that he tells his stories is so unique to other directors that it makes total sense that Marvel might have gotten antsy, no pun intended. I realize those words came out of my mouth as I say that, antsy about letting him work on the film, because it was probably wildly different in terms of tone than what they're used to.
Yeah, I think so. And I think he even when he's at his funniest, there's a big beating heart usually in the yeah. middle of his stories too, that Marvel tries for sometimes. I think it kind of got there with Doctor Strange to some extent. There's the sense that this story is about something much more than the usual comic book with much power comes much responsibility refrain.
Yeah.
But like The World's End, for example, I mean, on one level, it's just another alien invasion movie. On another level, it's a spoof of all alien invasion movies. But at its deepest level, it's a critique of the tendency of so many men to just be nostalgic for their youth and to constantly be trying to recapture that instead of growing up and realizing that all of those experiences are meant to inform the bigger and better things you will do. Mm. And that makes the movie worth talking about beyond just, you know, reliving the highlights, the funniest parts.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of the things that I like about it is the films that I've seen of his are beyond the structure, not the structure, beyond the stereotypes. So you know, the,
it makes me wonder if Ant-Man, you know, wouldn't have been one of the most substantial Marvel films. And, yeah. Maybe that's why it wouldn't have fit in.
Yeah. Well, I'm getting that sense. I mean, not just with Edgar Wright, but you see that Disney has a way that they want films to be made, not just in Marvel, but their Star Wars films as well. And now, you know, they bring in the young guys who are seen as sort of cutting edge, and they expect them to fall in line. The whole thing with the Han Solo movie right now, that they're with Lord and Miller, were sort of, you know, sort of running things their way, and Disney wasn't comfortable with it.
Right, and I anticipate that we're going to find out that their version was much funnier than what we're going to end up with.
Yeah.
But that's what they're best at, is the sort of wisecracking comedy. And there was always that potential in the character of Han Solo. So I expect that their young Han Solo movie would have been more of a comedy. Why not? You know, why not let Star Wars try all of these different directions? Because it's all fan fiction now anyway, right?
We're right.
all taking pieces of George Lucas's imagination and trying different spins on it. So you get something like Rogue One, which is very dark and grim and adult, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels more like a movie inspired by news footage in some ways than a lot of Star Wars stuff.
Mm.
So why not let it go to the lighter end of things? I have a feeling we're going to find out that that's part of what the powers that be at Lucasfilm were uncomfortable with. And that, you know, I've already heard one person say, you know, whether, and this is an, you know, unsubstantiated rumor, but I've already heard one person say that, well, what they were working on was the Ace Ventura Pet Detective version of Han Solo. And, you know, if there's any truth to that, that doesn't surprise me. That's the kind of personality that Lord and Miller bring to their projects. So Edgar Wright, like you were saying, brings a very different flavor, a very different style to his work than other Marvel movies. So maybe it's best. I mean, I said this in my review of Baby Driver. Maybe it's best that, well, I'm sure it was a horrible experience considering how much work he put into Ant-Man.
Yeah.
Maybe it's best that he focuses on projects that are his own completely and not an adaptation of somebody else's work. And Baby Driver, I mean, while you pointed out that this is the project that came out of the ruins of the Ant-Man debacle, he does say that this is the movie he has wanted to make the longest. I mean, that this movie, he wrote it as well, has been on his mind. I mean, this has been a dream project of his since before any of the movies we've seen. So it's great to see, you know, a passion project like that finally come to the screen.
Yeah, and you can get that sense as you watch it, too, because one thing I will say about a film like Baby Driver is whether or not you liked it, it does feel like from the opening sequence onwards that there's purpose behind it. And I'm not talking about grand purpose, but I mean, like, it just feels like the film has a certain place it already knows where it wants to go, and it's going to go there. Whether or not you like how it gets there, that's up for debate. But you can see that when he sat down and was writing this film, you get the feeling that he really knew what he wanted. So it makes sense if this is the one that he's been sort of gestating on the longest. Absolutely. What did you think of the film? What did you think of Baby Driver specifically?
Well, I suspect that some of the things that bother me about it, and so I'm already showing my hand a little bit here, but I suspect that some of the things that bother me about it are due to the fact that he's held on to it for so long. Because compared to Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End, three of the four films that that we've been talking about, it seems much more simplistic on the level of story. We should probably set up a little bit. Baby Driver, well, yeah, I guess you gave a quick synopsis at the beginning, but the beating heart of Baby Driver is not really its plot. The plot follows a, you know, kind of a heist comedy formula to some extent. And in other ways, it's a superhero movie because its main character, even though he's just the getaway car driver, is the best getaway car driver you've ever seen. And his magic only works if he's wearing his earbuds and is plugged into his iPod playlists. So in a way, you know, that's his Spider-Man spider bite. It's the music. And so as long as he's listening to these playlists, he can drive a car like you've never seen before. And what really makes the movie work is how fantastic these fusions of nostalgic pop songs and hip hop and rock and heavy metal, how they really propel his maneuvers in getting these bank robbers away from various bank robberies. And insofar as that goes, I think the movie is exhilarating, especially in the first half.
Yeah.
But on the level of story, there are a lot of things that feel like they were written by a high school or college student who wanted to write a heist movie and was inspired by all of the things that excited him in other heist movies. Hmm. So insofar as that goes, you've got the archetypes. You've got the cocky hero who has sort of an Elvis swagger to him. He's wearing, by the way, a Han Solo jacket over a white shirt, so he looks like young Han Solo.
Yep.
And he, of course, falls for a local beauty who works in a diner. And I swear that Deborah's character is inspired by one of the original young women from Twin Peaks, Shelley, who worked in the Double R Diner there. Deborah looks just like Shelley from Twin Peaks. You can almost just stop and edit your own commentary watching this movie as you speculate about where the inspirations came from. And then there's the gang of robbers who all have their own tics, their own, you know, idiosyncrasies. And then there's the leader of the bad guys gang, who you expect, because of all of the other ways that this movie is playing with the genre, is eventually going to reveal some kind of surprise of his own, and he does. I won't mention that spoiler here, but it's really fun watching how he plays with these conventions like someone who's grown up on them. Hmm. And what disappoints me is how undeveloped most of the characters are. Deborah, at the diner, the waitress, is charming and beautiful, and there's a lot of chemistry between her and Baby. That is the character's name. Yeah. And well, one of the best jokes in the movie, by the way, because that means that almost every song he plays is about him. what word shows up in more pop songs than Baby? As soon as you sense the chemistry between them, you're waiting to get her story. You're waiting to find out what she is going to bring to this narrative. And the answer is pretty much nothing. She's there to be true love for him, that he will take bigger risks than he would otherwise in order to be with her, in order to hit the road with her and escape all of this trouble. And she pretty much just becomes the screaming damsel in distress. Mm. And that was really disappointing, considering the way Edgar Wright has avoided that in his other movies. In The World's End, I'm forgetting her name. She's one of my favorite actresses, too. Anyway, the lead actress in The World's End ends up being ferocious in her own right compared to the guys who were fighting the alien invasion.
Is that Rosamund Pike?
Rosamund Pike, thank yes. you. Yes. If you're listening to this, Rosamund Pike, I'm so sorry. You've been one of my favorites since Pride and Prejudice. Okay.
sorry.
Oh, yes, and Gone Girl. I could just go down the list.
Yes, 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 yes.
She was incredible in a movie called An Education, which is worth tracking down if you missed it.
But that anyway, was her. I didn't realize that was her.
Yes, yeah, yeah. She's the supporting. She's in the supporting role that ends up taking over the movie. She's just fantastic.
Okay.
So I just feel like there were a lot of missed opportunities in Baby Driver for all of the fun of the music fusing with the action and the way that the background noise, you know, people on the street, a saxophone player on a street corner, eventually the gunshots and the squealing brakes, the way that Wright weaves all of those sounds into the actual music that we're hearing is something I haven't seen done before that I can think of in a movie. And that, I think, is its chief achievement and innovation, and that's what makes it worth seeing. I was just disappointed that I don't feel a big compulsion to go back and watch it again the way I have with all of his other movies.
Yeah, I can see that, actually. I'm glad you pointed that out, because that was something I noticed as well. Is when I came out of it, I was surprised at Lily James, that Deborah.
Lily James.
Yeah, Cinderella, Lily James. Yeah. Yes. I was surprised that her character didn't come out fully. You know, all she said is basically that she wants to get away. There wasn't much story that was given to her. I kind of liked the tropes in it only because it didn't really play with them much, but I felt like they kind of worked. I actually thought that it was interesting to see John Hamm sort of play a true villain. And a lot of times when you see John Hamm in a role, he's sort of the likable villain. And it starts off that way, certainly in this one. But by the end, he's the devil.
Yeah. And he has far more backstory than Deborah does.
Yeah.
He almost has more backstory than even Baby does. They don't detail the story. But when Jamie Foxx's character sort of provokes him, and brings out these hints about what it was that turned him into the kind of monster he is.
Yeah.
There's a very interesting story and social commentary there. So, yeah, Hamm, I thought, gives the best performance in the movie, frankly.
Yeah.
I think because he's so much fun, he's somewhat endearing. He's a little gross, especially in his romance with Sky Ferreira.
Right.
And then he's just he's just wonderfully terrifying. So I won't be surprised if we see John Hamm start showing up in Marvel movies or Star Wars movies or elsewhere in complicated villain roles, because now he's shown that he can do that just as well as he does the sort of oblivious, hormone-driven madman character.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, going back to the way the women were portrayed too, his relationship with Darling, I thought it was interesting that he got he was fleshed out, but yet again, here was another female that wasn't. Now, at first I thought, okay, they're not fleshing out either one, because he's got hers tattooed on his neck, she's got his tattooed on his neck, it's playing out. And their relationship is kind of fleshed out, but he really sort of takes over. So I wondered, that was something that I thought, okay, well, you know, I know you can't give everybody a story, but I thought that was something I would have liked to have seen. One thing that I did feel, though, is that it was refreshing to see a summer film worth talking about that was somehow, even if not perfect, was a cut above so much of the gutter tripe that's actually in theaters right now.
Oh, yeah.
And I loved Wonder Woman. But, I mean, since then, there's just been nothing really exciting. And even around that, there hasn't been a whole lot to say, here's something fresh. There's certainly not everything, even if it's promising, no worry, this is different. It's still part of some cinematic universe or something, you know, or some sequel or expanded thing. My fear is that, you know, Edgar Wright's going to make a movie about John Hamm's character now. We'll have a Baby Driver expanded universe. No, I thought there was such pop to it. And I think you, when you tapped into about the first half of the film, had almost enough joy in it that it felt like you were watching almost La La Land in the most bizarre mixture. And by the end, it had sort of succumbed to the darkness of Drive,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And which to me was a fascinating play. A fascinating back and forth. I mean, that opening sequence where he goes to get the coffee and he's singing down the street, and the lyrics to the song as he's singing them are appearing on the walls, you know, yes, in graffiti. It's like the entire world is celebrating, and the music is not just something he's listening to. It's just part of the world around him. Yep. I thought this is just stunning. I was really blown away by that personally.
Maybe what we'll see next then isn't a John Hamm backstory spinoff, but maybe we're about to see an honest to goodness musical.
Yeah,
I would go see that.
Yeah, and actually, at one point, that's what I thought we were going to get. You know, I would have liked to have known a little bit more, I guess, too, about Kevin Spacey's character, because all we sort of known is that he sort of picked him up off the street. I love Kevin Spacey, so that's not really an issue for me. But they gave me enough that I was on board. And I like that you said, talking about the tropes and the reveals and how there's sort of that flip at the end. But personally, I thought it was just so refreshing. Like, it felt like it was a film in the theater that didn't have giant robots or aliens, and you could go, here's something that might be worth your time to check out.
Yeah. Another place, though, where I do wish that the film had had more courage, I suppose at the end, when we see that this character, you know, is going to make his break and try to get away from these guys. But then he has to deal with the fact that he has participated in crimes. The movie comes up with a somewhat surprising way of reconciling, you know, we can't just let this character ride off into the sunset with his girl. There are real consequences that he needs to face for what he's been a part of. But even there, I felt like the movie wasn't brave enough. The conclusion of the movie, and this is another place where I felt disappointed, in a movie about car chases, in a movie about exhilarating high-speed action, it really frustrated me that the big final confrontation takes place in a parking garage.
Right.
They're not allowed to cut loose. And so that was a bit of a letdown. And then beyond that, the movie seems to just kind of cop out as far as whether this character is going to have to face how complicit he was in crimes that ended up with a lot of casualties.
Yeah.
Suddenly, you know, characters are coming out of the woodwork to praise him. And I'm thinking, I think that is a little bit dangerous, a little bit, I think it's succumbing to the desire we all have to let the charming villain off the hook. And sure, there's all this backstory about how he got involved with the bad guys and why we should give him a break. But that does mean that a lot of the violence that has taken place in the movie really was excused and taken so lightly that a lot of the gunshots, even deadly gunshots, were used just as percussion in the movie's ongoing soundtrack.
Hmm.
So I came away feeling like this could have been a movie about somebody seeking redemption, and it kind of becomes a movie about somebody who gets away with more than he probably should. And so that left me having very mixed feelings about the sort of anti-hero aspect of the film. Who are we cheering for at the end? And are we really just going to give special breaks to the guy we like while we celebrate the grisly demise of so many other characters because they had it coming?
Yeah, I can see that. One of the things I did like about the film is that he stops running. I appreciated the fact that, you know, the cops are there, and she sort of, I think, is she driving at the time? I think she is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he's asleep.
Sure.
He's asleep. And he puts her, you know, his foot on the brake or something, and says, and he says, you know, I have to do this. So I appreciated that. So yes, he does get away with it, but I mean, there's this great line where I believe it's John Hamm. It might have been Jamie Foxx, but says to him, the song's over, baby, but you still have to face the music. And I think that's when his iPod gets broken. And I actually liked the fact that, you know, even though everybody sort of says, oh, he's a nice guy, oh, he's good. And actually there's this great little visual joke where he's delivering pizza for Goodfellas Pizza, which is so good. And it's like, oh my gosh, you know. But the interesting thing is, as he's doing it, I think he delivers the pizza to one thing or to one house, and the guy says, you're a great fella. And so he's wearing the hat that says Goodfellas Pizza, and he's called a great fella, but we know what he's been doing all this time. So he actually sort of stops running, and I appreciated that. But one of the things that, like, that leads into the conversation then for me is, what does it mean to be that good fella? You know, they keep talking, like, throughout the entire film, he keeps saying things like, I worry I'm not good enough for you and whatnot. And everybody's like, no, you're a good guy. You're good. But, you know, by the end of the film, these deaths are on his hands. You know, he's not you know, it's not these things where he's in a car accident and people dying. Like, he runs Jamie Foxx through with a giant steel pillar.
Which was another moment of, oh no, he was one of the more interesting characters.
Yeah, nobody puts baby in a corner. I'm sorry. Wrong film. Wait, no, wrong film. How do you think that played out? Like, was baby a good guy? Like you said, these people come out of the woodwork and defend him. And what do you think that means?
Well, I think that the movie gives him several ways of showing just what a good guy he is at heart. I mean, you know, his foster father is deaf, and Baby has learned sign language in order to communicate with him, and is clearly full of love for that guy, and goes out of his way, risks his life in order to make sure that his foster father is in a good place while everything is crumbling around him. And that, you know, you have a lot of goodwill for him because of that. You see that, you know, at heart, this is a good guy. So I guess that the testimonies at the end, though, aren't so much about that. They're about, as he was stealing this car, he gave this woman, he handed this woman her purse before he took her car. It just sort of felt like a wish fulfillment parade of, we like this guy, so we don't want him to have to suffer any serious consequences. And I think it was one of the more obvious cases of something that I think we see in movies a lot, which is we give our heroes all kinds of room to cause all kinds of damage, and the movies very carefully avoid allowing us the time or the attention to think about the cost of those choices. I mean, just look at any of the recent DC comic book movies, with the exception of Wonder Woman. Where there's just massive urban devastation caused by the heroes as much as the villains. And the movie's just kind of like, well, you know, that's the way it goes. That's what you have to live with when, you know, in order to have superheroes. And all I'm doing is sitting there thinking about, the mass casualties that the movie isn't going to give more than a moment's thought. So I think that kind of cultivation of selective attention, so to speak, to particular characters and whether or not they're okay encourages, I think, especially now in this climate of us versus them politics, where everybody is defending their own vote or their own team, eager to pounce on any little misstep by somebody on the other side, but willing to accept massive compromises and turn a blind eye to all kinds of illegal activity by people on their own side. And I'm talking about either side of the political divide.
Sure.
Or either side of a sports rivalry. I mean, it's everywhere now. The fast-paced social media universe encourages us to attack wherever, you know, whenever there's blood in the water, but to ignore whenever, you know, we're the ones doing damage. And I think that this movie, while it's certainly not a grave offender on that count, it does make pretty obvious that we're going to give the good guys easy outs and the bad guys spectacular and thus, sadly, spectacularly satisfying on-screen deaths. And that's something I've just sort of lost patience for. The building up of an audience's dislike for somebody so that we feel gratification when we see them, you know, violently destroyed. In superhero movies, there's a cop-out around this often where the hero will make some righteous statement about, well, like Batman, for example, I'm not going to kill you. And then there's a pause, and then he says, but I don't have to save you either.
Yeah.
And he sort of steps aside and lets something crash and the villain be killed there. Or in one of the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies, you see Spider-Man choose not to kill the Green Goblin, even though the Green Goblin's own machine is about to destroy him. So we get both. We get the satisfaction of seeing the bad guy destroyed, you know, in big fireworks, but also the sort of the moral victory of knowing that, you know, we agree with the guy who wasn't going to commit that killing. And I think that does more harm to our collective conscience than we want to admit. And that mercy really needs to be embraced and celebrated if the value of that is going to sink in. I think of The Revenant as another great example of that, a movie that, man, most of the film critics I know love The Revenant. But I came out of The Revenant thinking, that movie tried so hard to have it both ways. It spent the whole movie ramping up our anticipation of seeing the bad guy finally get what he has coming. But it also gave the good guy some kind of righteous escape where he could say, no, I'm not going to commit this horrible revenge. I'm going to let you float 50 feet downriver where somebody else is waiting to kill you. And that made me so angry because I felt like I came away from that movie having been sold two contrary things where I can choose to take the righteous angle and say, well, the good guy made the right choice. But I still carry that exhilaration of seeing the big bad wolf land in the fireplace, so to speak. That's one of the reasons I value The Lord of the Rings so much. Why I value the original Star Wars trilogy so much is those are adventure stories where you had good guys and bad guys, but ultimately they come to a point of choosing either vengeful violence or mercy. And the mercy really resonates when it's shown. It isn't immediately followed by a celebration of the destruction of Darth Vader or of Gollum. There's real tragedy and real moral victories there.
Yeah, you're right. You know, in thinking about this particular film, at one point, you know, when I heard the speeches at the prison, at one point I wondered if they were sending up the genre there, but it does it with such, you know, aplomb that it feels like it's just sort of succumbing to it. It's interesting to hear them argue about the ending because Ansel and Edgar and Lily all have their own views of the ending. There's some debate about that. I don't know if you've heard this. So Edgar debates that, yes, he goes to prison. And because, of course, the comment is he's going to prison for 25 years. Now, this is one of the things I've heard is he goes to prison for 25 years. But I feel like I'm, you know, all these critics are missing the fact where he says in 5 years he can get out with good behavior. But people are saying, oh, he hasn't aged and he's been there for 25 years. They miss the point. But so he's been there and Edgar's like, oh, and he gets the girl at the end and it's sort of this sweet thing. Ansel suggests that it's unreasonable for Lily to wait. For Deborah to wait. So she moves on and the ending is actually a dream. Like this, his leaving is actually in his mind.
Well, I guess there is that shot of her waiting by the car in black and white, which the first time you see it in the movie is
a dream.
Clearly a fantasy.
Right.
The second time, though, it felt to me like there was enough of a dissolve of that image into the real world that I don't know if we're meant to wonder if it's a dream or not. I didn't get enough cues there, and I'm usually watching for something like that.
Yeah.
So many movies have pulled that on us now, whether it's Fight Club or, oh, I don't know. There's so many films that have left us with the, was it all a dream or not?
Right. Yeah, and, you're right.
I kind of hope that wasn't Wright's plan because that too has sort of been done to death. And if it was done here, it didn't work for me.
Well, I heard today that he's considering, of course, a sequel down the line. So because of how much money it made, but so I'm assuming it's the former. But you hear them talking about how good he is, and oh, he did this for me. He gave me my purse. And one of the things that I thought is maybe the film is confusing the term goodness with the idea of innocence. Because just by the very nature of his name, of course, calling him baby the entire time, and yes, he's the young kid, there seems to be this desire to keep him free from the world that he's immersed in. You know, you hear who was the man that was taking care of him, the deaf man that was taking care of him. I don't even know what their relationship was. Was he sort of the father figure, but what is his role?
Yeah, I believe he's like the foster father.
Foster father.
Played by C.J. Jones, Joseph, or Joe.
Yeah. So you have him saying you don't belong in this world and stuff. This is not where, you know, this is not where you're from, or this is not who you should be. And that's why I thought it was so interesting, too, that the killing starts coming from his hand. Because for so much of the film, you sort of feel like he's caught up in something that's bigger than him. And right. By the end of the film, he's completely succumbed to it. Like, the darkness is from him. He's vicious. And it is so, but when you hear the testimonies, it's like, oh, no, no, that's not who he is. Well, he has done these things, and he's done these things himself. He shoots John Hamm in the restaurant. He shoots him point blank. And that's one of the things that I appreciated is, that's why, you know, going back to what I said before, too, I think that's one of the things I appreciated about him stopping the car. Mm-hmm. Because it suggested that at very least he recognizes that he has done wrong. Even if nobody, by then nobody else seems to have noticed either. And I will say this, Deborah does not even seem fazed I mean, she doesn't like that these people are dying, but he's killed people, Deborah, with you there.
Yep. Well, you know, the whole thing feels like a fantasy, and the whole thing feels like what Wright is most interested in is the idea of the music.
Yes.
Synchronized with the action. And maybe that's why some of the other aspects of the storytelling didn't really resonate the way they do in the Cornetto trilogy. I've never been a big fan of Scott Pilgrim versus the World, but I know that people who love the comics think it's just fantastically that it's sort of the ideal adaptation. So I give him more credit there than just sort of the benefit of the doubt, because I've never been a fan of that comic, so I don't know. I didn't have all the fanboy highs that the rest of the audience did. But with this one, it just felt kind of extra disappointing, because what's so good about it is so good. And you can feel the personal passion in those early scenes. I just wish that the story had the resonance and the solidity that the others do, so that Shaun of the Dead isn't just a spoof of zombie movies. It's a great zombie movie. The World's End isn't just lampooning alien invasion movies.
Yeah,
it's epic, and it has an ending that goes so far above and beyond end of the world kinds of stories that it's better than most of the things it's making fun of.
Yeah, it's true. Maybe we should talk a little bit about the music specifically, though. There's a fascinating relationship between Baby and his soundtrack. Not just, you know, driving aside, music in the film sort of defines it. And I was wondering how you thought that played out together.
Well, I keep waiting to find out, you know, more about Edgar Wright's choices. I mean, a lot of it's just that these songs sound great as soundtracks, and that's something that Quentin Tarantino is a genius about. You know, I play just today, as a matter of fact, I was playing the soundtrack to Kill Bill Volume 2 because his song selection there was so perfect that I cannot play those songs without visualizing some of the incredible edits, some of the incredible camera moves, some of the choreography of those fights. Even just the colors of some of the sequences in the Kill Bill movies carry over to when I'm listening to that soundtrack. Here, I think, you know, if, as he says, he's held on to this idea for so long, you know, he has been revising his playlist for this for years and years and years, probably based on stuff he listened to in the car while he was driving. So you get the John Spencer Blues explosion. You get the Beach Boys. You get Dave Brubeck. You can get R.E.M. in there, an R.E.M. instrumental, if I remember right. Blur, Queen. Queen plays a big part in the film. And, of course, then the Simon and Garfunkel song Baby Driver eventually shows up. Those are all songs in which most of them are songs in which the name Baby, the name Baby figures prominently. Most of the songs have some lyrical connection to the plot. I think my favorite musical flourish in the whole thing is the way that Baby is able to connect with Deborah because of that brilliant Beck song, that hilarious Beck song, Deborah, from the album Midnight Vultures.
Yep.
And as soon as I realized that's where they were going for her, I was just overjoyed, because that's one of my favorite moments in Beck's whole enormous catalog. But then Wright surprises us and Deborah by having Baby, with his encyclopedic knowledge of music, pull out the only other song we know of called Deborah, by T-Rex, so that he actually has a musical gift for her.
Mm.
And that is the kind of thing that only somebody who grew up in the era of mixtapes, real mixtapes, as in cassette tapes made in the 80s, would appreciate. So in a way, this movie has an unlikely relationship with the movie High Fidelity.
Yeah.
John Cusack and Jack Black, in that there is a real love of the art of the playlist, the art of putting songs together in a way that is personally meaningful for the mixer, but also is meant as a gift for the listener. I mean, when I was in college, that was sort of the love language of our generation. We would make mixtapes for one another.
Mm.
And if you really listened and somebody was really good at it, there was a lot of thought and planning in the succession of the songs. There were songs with lyrics that you hoped the person you were giving it to, that person would notice that you picked songs with lyrics that had some personal connection to them. So it really is a celebration of that art form, which in today's disposable, low-quality MP3 culture, where music now is more about the ego behind a sensational and surprise release than it is about the actual quality of the music, I really am down with that. And when it comes to nostalgia, nostalgia can be just a waste of time and a looking back, or it can be a way of saying, we need to get back something that we lost that was worth having. So that's one of the great values of the film, I think, is that it's not just chase music, but it's music that you can tell that the artist has lived with and loves, and so much so that it super connects the points in the story.
Yeah, it's interesting to me how much is defined by the music in this one, to the point of, you know, you hear Deborah and Baby, and they talk so much, as we've said here, about what songs do they get, you know, who are their songs, and oh, you're Baby, so you get all the songs, you know, pretty much everything. She says my sister's name is Mary, she got all the songs. And it's interesting that there seems to be this desire to be defined by some sort of epic call to reality. Mm-hmm. And I think you see that too in the way that Baby records everything. Mm-hmm. And then mixes it. So he is taking random sentences of people and turning them into music. So it's not that he's hiding, just that he's hiding in the music, which is what the obvious look is. You know, I'm driving, this is the music I need to listen to hide from my fears, my past. I need to keep the tunes moving. You know, you could look at that. It's more than that. He's trying to bring the music and make it almost tangible, which is one of the things why I love that scene where he's walking down the street and the graffiti's on the wall, because there's this close connection between fleshing out reality in the music and sort of defining it through something unique and beautiful and creative.
Uh-huh.
And I think that that's more than just a coping mechanism. You know, I may be working for the mob, you know, initially because he has to, but I'm still taking that and turning it into something.
Yeah.
You know, there is something that needs to be created in this. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, soundtracks, for a long time, we haven't really talked about soundtracks, but now you have a film even like this. You've got Guardians of the Galaxy, which before film comes out, people want to know, what songs did you pick?
Yeah.
You know, I've heard them actually asking James Gunn already, what songs do you want to do for Volume 3? He says, so far I've got 120 songs.
And you wonder how much of the story and its twists and turns are riding on those decisions. Because clearly those songs have correlations with what's happening in the plot. So
yeah, exactly. And I think it feels like it's been a long time since, you know, outside of the obvious, the musical, that music has played such a central role, especially action filmmaking.
It's a major part of the revival, the return of Twin Peaks, actually.
Hmm.
The new episodes of Twin Peaks One of the big surprises, you're just talking about the formal structure of the thing, is that David Lynch has chosen to end almost every episode with a song played in the Roadhouse Bar by a band that is getting a chance of a lifetime to appear in front of an audience that is completely enthralled. And some of the bands that they've featured have been new, and some of them have been old favorites. Nine Inch Nails had a major role to play in the last in episode 8, which played a week ago. So that show, Sharon Van Etten, I was stunned to see her show up at the end of an episode and play a song at the Roadhouse. And I expect there are other big surprises coming. There's been it's been widely reported that Eddie Vedder shows up.
Really?
In Twin Peaks. And so I'm expecting to see him in an upcoming episode, and I don't know whether he'll be at the bar playing a song or whether he's actually going to play a character. I don't want to spoil anything for anybody, but I think that he has shown up already in one of the episodes in a role that you wouldn't have noticed unless you were really watching the shadows carefully. I love that David Lynch is making music an even bigger part of this new stretch of the storytelling than it was in the original. So maybe we're going to see the art of the soundtrack album come back in a way that we haven't seen since maybe the early 90s, when movies like Until the End of the World came out and the soundtrack was even bigger and more popular than the movie of that title.
Yeah. Well, Jeffrey, this has been a great conversation. I love having you on, but we should probably start to wrap up. Let's do Screen It or Skip It.
Okay.
Baby Driver, Screen It or Skip It?
Oh, definitely screen it. The highs are so worthwhile. I'm just not sure it's going to have the longevity that the others have. But maybe I'll see it again, and I'll see 100 things I didn't see the first time. So we'll see.
Yeah, this is a definite screen it for me as well, and I think for the same reason. I liked it very much. I'd like to see it again to see if there's enough there to flesh it out for repeat viewings, which I'm not sure yet. It doesn't quite have the full amount of glee of the Cornetto trilogy or something like that makes you excited to watch it a second time, because the second half gets quite gritty. But yeah, I'm very interested. I'm very interested to see it again, and I give it a solid screen it as well. It's a well-made film. Before we fully wrap up though, Jeffrey, I thought I'd ask you one more question. I was wondering, there's been some real surprises this year, and there's been some stuff we've missed, but also a lot of stuff coming. Could you give us maybe one thing, maybe we could share one thing that surprised us this year and one thing that we're looking forward to in the second half?
Well, most of the movies I've liked this year have been big surprises to me. I mean, I kind of knew I was going to like the Lego Batman movie because I loved the Lego movie so much, and it surpassed my expectations. I thought it was just fantastic. I can't wait to see it again. Wonder Woman was a big surprise to me. I haven't liked the DC movies, but that one, I just had the time of my life. I thought it was one of the best superhero movies I've ever seen. But the big surprises, and I think at this point, the things that are likely to show up in my top 10 or my top 5 of the year are mostly movies that have flown under the radar. Get Out was a big hit, and that's definitely one of my top 10. But I really, really loved a film called The Lost City of Z, which is from a director named James Gray, that starred Charlie Hunnam and Robert Pattinson and Sienna Miller. It's based on a true story about the British explorer Percy Fawcett. This is an explorer who, I don't know, when you see him on the movie poster or in a trailer, you're going to think, oh, man, this is a total Indiana Jones ripoff. That's not the case. In fact, Percy Fawcett is the historical figure who inspired Indiana Jones. So this is a historical epic that has the scope and just the visual enchantment of something like Apocalypse Now. And although it doesn't get as bloody and as nightmarish as that film does, it digs into a lot of the same kinds of questions about human ambition and what price we are willing to pay to achieve some kind of legendary status. One of the things I love about The Lost City of Z is that the character starts out striving for legendary status, but ends up on a much more spiritual quest, on an increasing sense that there is much, much more to this world than we realize, and that maybe we are meant for a kind of kingdom, a kind of civilization that we haven't even realized yet. And so I was very, very impressed by that film. I'm really eager to see it again. But I got to tell you, if you get a chance to see it on a big screen, this is one of those movies. That's the way to see The Lost City of Z.
Yeah, I hadn't seen that one. I mean, I'd seen the trailer, but I hadn't heard many reviews other than some people sort of said, hey, it's not bad. But it's really interesting to hear that, that you liked it so much.
So that's the one that's the surprise for me this summer. Looking forward, there are so many things I can't wait to see. But probably the top of that list would have to be a film called A Ghost Story, which has just been getting fantastic reviews and is coming out, I think, next week or very, very soon.
Yeah.
If it's not playing already. And that stars Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. It's directed by David Lowery, who directed those two in a movie called Ink and Body Saints. And then, of course, he directed the remake of Pete's Dragon that came out recently. He's a very interesting director. And the rave reviews on this one have me very, very intrigued. So I'm looking forward to that one very much.
That's certainly on my radar as well. I'm glad that when you talk about surprises, that you mentioned Get Out. It was a big hit. And yet, that was one that I wasn't on my radar. I saw the trailer and I thought, I don't understand why this is such a big, success. It looks like it's pretty standard story based on the trailer, but it was actually refreshing that the trailer didn't give away much of the film. So that was, I mean, that for me was quite a surprise. That was sort of my surprise. I would even throw
these are the best of times and the worst of times when it comes to trailers. I've been so frustrated with so many trailers recently that have been spoiling even the ends of movies. But then you get something like the comedy The Big Sick that just opened.
Which
is just fantastic and is full of twists and surprises that the trailer didn't even hint about. So that's another good example of that.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I'd forgotten. Yes, I saw that last week. The Big Sick was something that I would recommend as well. It's in theaters right now. It was very well done. One thing, and I'm excited to see a Ghost Story as well. I would have to say that I am very much anticipating what could be an absolute utter disaster, but the Blade Runner sequel. Man.
Yes.
I'm giddy at the very thought of this film, and I recognize that it very well could be an utter mess. But, you know, the truth was, though, when the first film came out, critics hated it. It was 20 years later that people said that was brilliant.
Right.
So definitely. I'm really intrigued to see what happens here. Because, I mean, I love Villeneuve's work. I'm a big fan. Some films are great and some films are not. But all of his films have held my interest.
Yeah, from the big ones like Arrival to some of the lesser known ones like Enemy.
Yeah.
Which is a deeply disturbing film and has what may be the most shocking final image of a movie I have ever seen. And that's all I'm going to say, because I really want to preserve that surprise for people. But I don't think I've ever literally jumped back. I watched it at home.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought everything was wrapping up. And then this final image came up on the screen and just about gave me a heart attack. Yeah, Villeneuve is really interesting. His plots are so heavily mysterious and psychological, and that is the greatest hope I have for this Blade Runner sequel, is that they've given it to somebody who does not tell shallow stories or merely seek to create a money-making franchise. He goes deep in whatever he's working on. So I have tentative hopes for that film, but at the same time, I have said so many times over the last 20, 30 years, if there's one movie I hope they never make a sequel to, it's Blade Runner. So,
yep.
Here we go.
I know. Every time there's a new image, I'm lapping it up. I'm very excited, and I hope it's not a disaster. But yes, Jeffrey, thank you so much for being on. It's always great to talk with you. I really appreciate the chance, and How can our listeners connect with you? Is there a way that that they can keep up with what you're doing?
Oh, sure. I mean, I live in public, so it's easy to it's easy to connect with me. I'm on Facebook at facebook.com/Jeffrey Overstreet. But my film-focused Facebook page is at facebook.com/lookingcloser. And my website, my official website, where all of my film reviews are archived, is lookingcloser.org. And that's where I write about film, I write about music, I write about faith. And during the summer, I write and blog a whole lot more than during the rest of the year, because the rest of the year I'm teaching. So I'm also on Twitter at Overstweet.
I like it.
O-V-E-R-S-T-W-E-E-T. So.
Well, that's great. Great. Thank you so much. And for those of you at home, a reminder that you can find us on Podomatic, on Stitcher, on iTunes, on SoundCloud. And actually, if you go to the podcast page on screenfish.net, you can download Fishing for More, which is small group questions that you can have if you decide that you're going to go with your friends to see Baby Driver and talk about it after and try and help stir the conversation up where you are. Normally, we're back in 2 weeks. We will be back in one, because we are going to cover the new Spider-Man film, and we wanted to get that out as soon as possible. So next week, we will be back with Spider-Man Homecoming. We're excited about that. But once again, Jeffrey, thank you so much. It was great to chat.
Thank you for taking the time to give these subjects real, real close attention and thorough discussion. It's hard to find that anymore. So thank you, Steve, for that.
I appreciate that. Thanks, Jeffrey. And for the rest of you at home, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish. You can come right here.
You said you wanted a Baby Driver.
Perfect. That's perfect.
I want a Baby Driver too.
I want a Baby Driver too.
I call Baby Driver.
Second of all, you're not a baby. You're 7 now.
I'm a baby.
Second of all, you're not a baby. You're 7 now.
I'm a baby. Dada, I'm a baby.
Are you a baby? Okay, you gotta be quiet when Daddy's talking on this one.